Curry about Lost Connections. That's going to be the pledge premium for that thing. Please help support the show for next week. And I think I'm off the next week for a special edition of Press Watch. But KBOO Fun Drive is coming up next week. I want to just reiterate that. You can, if you want to hear me actually play music, there's Smoke Signals from the Speakeasy from 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. every other Saturday night. And I have one coming up, or Saturday morning. I have one coming up this week. Bye for now.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 11 o'clock. Coming up next is Between the Covers. David Naiman talks to Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award finalist Christine Schutt about her latest story collection, Pure Hollywood. And 11:30, Black Book Talk co-host Emma Jackson Ford, O.B. Hill, and Patricia Wells discuss what's on their bookshelves this month. Listeners are invited to call in and share their current reads. All of these KBOO programming are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio starts our spring membership drive starting April 8th. And before that, we'd love to hear from you directly about why you support KBOO. My name is Mo, a KBOO volunteer, and I support KBOO because I grew up with KBOO. It's part of my life, and I feel having a community outlet like KBOO is so important because it creates a more vibrant community and a place where different ideas are not only heard, but honored. Why do you support KBOO? Call us and let us know at 503-231-8032, extension 302, to leave a voicemail or tag us with your support on your social media posts. And thank you for supporting KBOO.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Grendel's Coffee House is open daily until 6 p.m. More information is available on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550. That's 503-595-9550.
Today's guest is the writer Christine Schutt. Schutt is the author of two short story collections and three novels. Her debut collection, Nightwork, was chosen as the best book of 1996 for the Times Literary Supplement by the poet John Ashbery, who described it as pared down but rich, dense, fevered, exactly right, and even eerily beautiful. It turned out to be no coincidence that it would be one of America's leading poets who would pick Schutt's debut book of prose as the best book of the year, as Schutt has gone on to become one of the great practitioners of the poetics of the sentence. Christine Schutt earned an MFA in creative writing from Columbia, studied at Barnard with the novelist and critic Elizabeth Hardwick, and ultimately did a deep dive into the world of Gordon Lish's writing pedagogy, with Schutt as one of the early students and Lish as Schutt's editor for her debut, Nightwork, at Knopf. Christine Schutt taught English and creative writing for 20 years at the Nightingale Bamford School for Girls, has taught undergraduate writing at Columbia, Sarah Lawrence, Amherst, Syracuse, and the Sewanee Writers Conference, and is a consulting editor at Diane Williams' literary annual, Noon. Christine Schutt's debut novel, Florida, was a finalist for the National Book Award, and her second novel, All Souls, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction. She has won multiple O. Henry Prizes, a Pushcart Prize, and a fellowship from the Guggenheim Foundation, and we're lucky to have her here today to talk about her newest collection of stories, Pure Hollywood and Other Stories, just out in paperback from Grove Press. Michael Silverblatt says of Christine Schutt, that she writes the most singular and perverse sentences of anyone working today. The Guardian warns that wherever your literary comfort zone is, the chances are that Christine Scott is outside it. Publishers Weekly says of Pure Hollywood, "Nobody writes like Scott, and her latest collection is the perfect entry point for readers new to her work. In each of the collection's 11 stories, Scott gives readers dissipated women staggering to the brink of sanity, desperate men with foggy intentions, and an eerie atmosphere that radiates menace, sexuality, and murder. Scott is always in control in this work by an experimental American writer of unparalleled style." The BBC says, "Think Gatsby with a twist of Didion. Otessa Moshfegh heralds Pure Hollywood as pure gold." And Claire V. Watkins says, "Christine Scott is easily among the liveliest stylists of our time. But these 11 stories prove we ain't seen nothing yet. Each is a wonder, pickled in her crystalline idiom and cured under her brutal, astonishing wit." Welcome to Between the Covers, Christine Scott.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So before we talk about Pure Hollywood and the way it both continues and departs from the work that comes before it, I was hoping maybe we could start with the origin story of you as a writer, because I think it would be of interest to aspiring writers and also possibly even inspirational in that regard. Because one of the notable things about your history is that you studied writing seriously in your 20s, and yet your first book didn't come out until your late 40s. Yet right. Once that happened, from the get-go, from the late 40s on, you were in the conversation for the Pulitzer, the National Book Award, winning O. Henry Prizes. But during those two decades prior to you publishing Nightwork, you were a writer, and things weren't necessarily coming together. So I was hoping maybe you could talk about your days at Columbia and Barnard with Hardwick, and what your writing was like before you sort of figured it out, maybe how you look back on those decades pre-Nightwork, working hard at writing and not having things manifest?
Sure. I'm happy to talk about that. I went to Columbia in my late 20s, and I studied with Richard Yates for the first semester, and that was fine. Very good. He's a wonderful story writer, of course. And in any event, what came out of all of my work at Columbia was that I'd wanted to be a poet, so I was very interested in language and the way sentences are made and sound, all of that. And I could write a good sentence. I had spent, before I applied to the schools, some time imitating people who are sentence magicians. John Updike is still quite remarkable in those ways, and Harold Brodkey and Renata Adler. And I also loved Elizabeth Hardwick at the time, and she was teaching at Barnard, so I went across the street, and I studied with her, and that was extraordinarily rewarding. And I wrote short things for her. And in any event, the long and the short of it is that while you can write a very, very good sentence, you don't necessarily know how to put them all together to tell a good story. And that was my problem. I would start out in a strong way, and then the story would sort of dribble away. I was trying to write Anne Beattie stories. That was a disaster. In any event, when I left Columbia, my last meeting, I remember there was a woman who. Hannah Green, who said to me very much what I'm saying now is, you can write very well, wonderful sentences and so forth, but it may take you 20 years to figure out how to tell a story. And in fact, that was true. And I'm not sure I would even know how to tell a story if I hadn't met Gordon and studied with him. In any event, in the meantime, because I've since in teaching in different places met other people whose story is very much like mine. That is, they did well in school and in their MFA programs, and they left, and they still couldn't quite get something to work. That was my case during the time I was married, and then after I was married, I kept on writing and failing, but I did write, and I do think you get better. At maybe it's just a sentence, but you do get better. So in any event, after I was teaching, I had two boys, and by the time I met Gordon, I had been through enough experiences, not all of them happy, to figure that no matter what happened in his workshop or what he said, and he could be very brutal, I wasn't afraid.
Yeah.
You could say anything. And but all that work on the sentence actually paid off, and I've met for the first time somebody who felt that was really all you needed was a sentence. Nobody had told me that, and he made the whole process very, very easy, just by following his very simple instructions, which were, once you land on a sentence that is going to cost you something and that is interesting to you, your only obligation is to look at it long and hard and to find out how you're going to, what term in that sentence is the strongest, and how you can capitalize on it, take it up and turn it around. In any event, it was a very liberating, wonderful time in my 40s, but it had, when I was told in my late 20s it would take me 20 years, that's devastating news, because at 20 years seems a long time.
Well, before we sort of unpack the what you learned from Lish.
Yes.
When you were under Hardwick,
yes,
you did write a novel.
Yes.
And she told you you should join the large club of writers whose first novels get put away in a, buried in a desk drawer.
Yes.
What was that novel like, and have you ever looked at it again?
I've never looked at it again, but it's very much a lot of the same stories, far more autobiographically relayed, that I took up when I studied with Lish. I do think a lot of our material, we don't forget it. It comes back, and it comes back in remarkable forms. It took me a while to see that in Night Work, my very first story was a story that I had been trying to write at Columbia some 20 years before. So that... that was interesting to me. You take up the same material, but by then you know how to perhaps manipulate it in a way that's really going to suit. And that's what happened.
You've also, in other interviews, talked about an abusive relationship you were in just after you got divorced.
Yes.
As being sort of a turning point for you in your writing life.
Yes.
When he took out your work and started mocking it.
Yes.
What about that experience shifted things for you?
Yeah, those are very, very, very difficult times. This was a person who was verbally abusive, although he certainly had the capacity to be physically abusive. And he did take my work out one evening and started to read it, and not read it too much aloud, though, and a little bit to himself and make fun of it. And I thought then, of all the things that had been said to me, and all of them I believed, stupidity and so forth, I didn't believe he believed what he was saying, actually. I just, for some perverse reason, I didn't believe it. And it was comforting to me that at least I still held on to that, that I thought, no, I don't think it's so bad. And I don't think you think it's so bad. But certainly living with someone like that, you either, well, they're either going to kill you or you're going to kill them in some way. Hmm. So that was my experience. Initially, when he took it out of the drawer, of course, you're terrified. But anyway, that worked out well.
Uh-huh. Mm. Well, when you were living in Portland a couple years ago,
yes,
teaching as part of the Tin House Portland State collaboration, you were telling me about the unique proposal that Gordon Lish made to you around your apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love it if you would just share that.
Yes.
And maybe a little bit of your remembrances of those early days.
Yes.
So what did Lish propose to you when you started flirting with the possibility of studying with him?
Well, it was very hard. My meeting him was somewhat serendipitous, as it turned out. I'd been reading stories and discovering that the man behind the stories was someone named Gordon Lish, and I then had tea with a woman who was actually studying with him and whose stories I liked. And but to find him or to figure out how you were going to get into these things, I didn't understand how any of that worked. Not that I was so bold as to really do a lot of prying. And a friend of mine one day had sent stories to Gordon, and he liked them, and he wanted to meet her. And she told me about this, and I was very excited for her. And in the middle of the meeting, she left him to make a call to me and to say he was crazy, and he wanted to have his classes in her apartment. And she let no one in her apartment. And so I was very excited. And I said, well, send him to me, because I happened to be in the neighborhood that was near to his apartment, as was she. So he did. He came over right away. And it's one of those meetings you don't forget, aside from the fact that he has a wonderful costume, a cowboy hat and one of the cowboy coats, and all in khaki, and he looked like a writer. His white hair and a kind of wildness and a ruddy complexion, and he came in very forcefully and looked around and sat down, wanted to know my background and everything else, dismissed Columbia entirely. I remember one of the things I really moved me, or not moved me, but I was done for, was nobody had ever really called me Scut by my last name, just as you would a writer, and knew how to say my name, moreover. And so he said, Scut, I'm going to make a proposal, because his classes were very expensive. If people paid, no one ever asked anybody else, although he made a show of it sometimes. But I'd already decided I certainly was never going to spend a penny on learning how to write. That I'd already done in graduate school, and that was enough. But fortunately, he said, here's the deal. You let me have my classes in your apartment, both the sort of a beginning class and then the master class, or whatever he was calling them. They were on, I think it was a Tuesday and a Thursday, and these classes ran for 6 hours. He said, I'll let you attend them if I can have them here, and you get the whole thing for free. So I did think that was a great deal, and it was a great deal. It was so exciting. My apartment's very, very, very tiny, well under 1,000 square feet, and we had a lot of people in the opening classes. Sometimes 25 people would come, and they would be down the hallway and in the kitchen. Lots of people ultimately elected to stay in the kitchen on the floor, or stay on the floor in the hallway, simply because I think Gordon was a very scary person. You never knew what he was going to say and what he was going to say about you and how you were going to be exposed. So the classes got smaller over the course of the term until they were finally manageable, but they were just thrilling. It was as thrilling to be in the class that where people were in their work was in a rougher condition as it was to be in the class that was accomplished, by which I mean, you know, Amy Hempel and Mark Richard and people, and those people really, they only made appearances, but they would read or they would contribute. It was, well, nobody contributed, I should say. Only Gordon talked. and we just hoped that if we were, when we were asked to read, we hoped to get beyond the first sentence. And that was always an ambition. In any event, I loved his aesthetics. I had been living that way most of my life, so I had no trouble and was extraordinarily happy in the classes.
You must have been if you're not only hosting 6 or 7 or 8 hour long class marathons,
yes,
attending those marathons,
yes,
but then being so inspired to write until 4 in the morning after the after the marathons were over.
Oh yes, yeah. Absolutely, it was very thrilling. It was thrilling. That's all. You read and he would take things apart or say what was working. And sometimes if you'd read something and you knew it was good, he would go back to you again and again and again in the evening and say, "Read that again.
Oh, wow.
Save us."
I love that.
Yes. No, it's very dramatic in the way that you were when you were first embarking on this, talking about the value of your work and holding it up like a chalice, and he always went back to Araby, and he spoke of it as a really, your life depends on it, and not to be playing games and not to be silly. Anyway, I found everything he said on writing on the mark, inspiring, provocative, all the things you would hope a teacher would be. And he just made such smart moves. He remembered your text, and he'd have you go back, and then he'd pick over a word. It was for someone who'd been proceeding at a very slow pace, as I had, and on a sentence-by-sentence kind of level, even then, it was what I'd been waiting to hear, I think, most of my life. It was wonderful.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Christine Scutt about her latest story collection, Pure Hollywood. So there's a little mystery or paradox in the way you're describing things that I want to unpack a little bit, and that is that in the first part of your career, you say you were already confident about your sentences, but all the feedback is you're getting is you haven't figured out how to write a story. And yet you figure out how to write a story by finding a teacher who tells you you only need to focus on your sentences.
Right.
So, which seems like a paradox.
Yes,
so
it is.
I'm going to read something you once said about Lish and then a little bit more.
Okay.
And then I want to ask you some questions about this.
Okay.
So you once said this about Lish: "I value no one's opinion more than Gordon's when it comes to assessment of fiction, and while in his class I took notes, I have profited from reading again. I tried to live by many of his phrases. Stay open for business. Be Emersonian. Say what no one else has the courage to say, and you will be embraced. Reveal what you would keep secret. You will stay awake when writing such a story. You will also write very, very carefully with so much at stake. Each sentence is extruded from the previous sentence. Look behind you when writing, not ahead. Your obligation is to know your objects and to steadily, inexorably darken and deepen them." So I was hoping we could unpack this idea of the next sentence being extruded from the previous, that to figure out where to go next involves a counterintuitive move of looking back instead of forward. So like when Diane Williams was here and she was holding forth Gary Lutz's essay, "The Sentence is a Lonely Place," is perhaps the best description of Lish's language worldview mm-hmm. and also of this move in particular. Mm-hmm. And while Lutz talks about the sentences of many writers from Barry Hanna to Sam Lipsyte, you're sort of the star of this essay mm. and his most recent one also, The Poetry of the Paragraph. And he spends the most time examining and revealing the mechanics of your sentences. And he describes this Lischian technique of looking backward, which I think Lisch called consecution, and this is Lutz's words, a recursive procedure by which one word pursues itself into its successor by discharging something from deep within itself into what follows. The discharge can take many forms and often produces startling outcomes. And then he takes a sentence where you use the surprising word tallowy by listening to what comes before in the sentence. And the sentence is, here is the house at night, lit up tall and tallowy. And Lutz claims you would have never arrived at this word tallowy without looking back in the sentence. So I was hoping maybe you could talk about consecution. On the one hand, it seems conceptually simple, but even when I talk about it with Diane Williams or I read the Gary Lutz article, there's still something a little bit mystifying about it. And maybe you could talk about it in your own words, and if you teach it, how you go about teaching it.
Gary's description, I think, is very fancy, and I don't understand it exactly the way he's expressed it. In terms of tallowy or something, it was just a matter of sound. I thought the house looked waxy and white, and I was focused in my heart on that it looked candle-like. And I think I picked tallow, certainly maybe for the T's and other sounds, but that's when it comes down to the sounds or the particular words, a lot of it has to do, I think, with just simple, literary tricks. I mean, it's alliterative or it has some quality, some sound that it's always, for me, it's always a sound that I find mimics or mirrors what's sort of going on. The attitude of the character or the sourness of the scene or if I want to flatten it. So I'm really more or less proceeding on sound.
Maybe this is a good time to hear one of your stories.
Sure. Family Man. Tonight, on the shore of a low lake in a low spot in the Kettle Moraine, black water, churchy trees, Moss sees his concave wife in urgent conversation with their daughter Grace, sly girl, long hair slung over one shoulder, bare ear cocked close to whatever her mother is saying to her. Grace, all of a sudden, turns on her heel to see him looking at her. Then Grace is standing next to him. With the slightest attention, he has charmed her away from the conversation she was having with his wife, her mother, to walk with him. She talks in a small voice without showing her teeth. Moss moves closer to hear. It may be the way she uses her tight lips, but he can't hear her and bends close to ask, has she ever been in love? When his wife rushes up from behind. So Moss leaves the women and turns back to the house. The next morning, he bolts a split birch trunk together, and it bleeds. Theirs, a country quiet life, is satisfying, or should be. His daughter hoped something would happen, and it did, in the shape of a man blued by symbols that crinkled when he tensed his arms. Moss watched shapes rustle on the man and saw, too, that his wrist was wreathed, royal, and he was not young. He was ready to inherit. Opalesce is a gauzy word to describe what the sky is doing. From the picture window, Moss follows winter colors, white slate, steely skies, and yellows. He puts his hand out to the show and feels the cool glass against his palm and is steadied by the sensation. His lovely, boxed life, snow falling outside, very pretty, while he stands inside, well and warm, entirely comfortable in comfortable shoes. The past sleds behind him. Door County, 1951, poking raw squirrel over smoky coals, washing the meal down with whiskey. Scant comforts. Even indoors, the scratchy camp blankets felt wet. He was most often cold. Early morning, hooping into Lake Michigan, then gibbering back to a tasteless breakfast of something gluey they ate with a spoon. No cream to cut his coffee. No cushions for the austere chairs on which they sat, moss, butt-numbed and dumb. 1951, the year he met his wife. He hears his name, but has no desire to know how he might be described in the future. A glass of water, a flavorless man, at best on a white tablecloth, a goblet of melted ice with the slightest curl of lemon in it. Through the blinds, a blade of sunlight cuts the glass in half and shows up dust.
It was a real pleasure having you on the show today,
Christine. Thank you very much. It's been fun.
We're talking today to Christine Scutt, the author of Pure Hollywood. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 11:30. Coming up next is Black Book Talk. Co-hosts Emma Jackson Ford, O.B. Hill, and Patricia Wells discuss what's on their bookshelves this month, and they invite listeners to call in and share their current reads.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series.